Hey, Payal, thank you for coming in. You have just a wondrous background and history of accomplishment and success and contribution and impact. And it continues to accelerate across so many communities and so many domains. So you're just awesome. So thank
Oh.
you for coming in and sharing your experiences with our audience.
Thank you, Stephen, for having me. And it's always amazing to chat with you and have dialogue about important issues and anything I can do to shed light and awareness on things that we have in common and share as values. I'm always happy to do that. So thank you.
So just to give a little bit of context, my audience has CEOs and investors and scientists and engineers and students. So it's very broad. Though when anytime I do an article or I put an interview up, and if I do any tracking, it tends to sort of skew to more towards CEOs. So just give you a heads up, or board members and things like that. But the people are always curious. I always get this feedback, when I do an interview, like, what made you this wonderful person? Maybe there was one, two, three inflection points. Could have been the age of three or five, or that really helped shape your life to what you do today and all the impact you're having today.
Well, if I had to, boy, it's a great question. It's a great question people ask, and I think we should all be asking that of each other because I think everyone has a story that's amazing and that brought them to where they are today, and who they'll be, their trajectory. So I'll try to share mine in as short of a, I'll give you a synopsis of it. But I feel like, being an immigrant, coming to this country as a 14-year-old, a junior in high school, was one of the milestones, definitely that shaped who I am, but also who I wanted to be. I was very unaware as a teen, and I was lost as an immigrant and as a high schooler. There was lots of things going on at that age, obviously, but how I was finding myself in a new school at that age in a new country. Luckily, English was not an issue. I learned English in India and I was fluent. So it was not the language, it was more assimilation. So learning to assimilate, learning to read the room, learning to assimilate, it was a tough lesson to learn, but I think one of the biggest milestones in my life. The second milestone would be going to Berkeley. I was an EECS major first 2 years, and I spent almost the entire first 2 years of my undergrad in the basement of Quarry Hall coding with, it was a class of 500 students, and there was, I could count the number of girls on my hand, right? So maybe four or five girls and 400 boys, or actually close to 500 boys. And it was great. Like there was no issues, but you could notice that we were definitely outnumbered by a lot. And so what was that? Like less than 0.5% of girls that were coding. And so I spent 2 years doing that, and I realized, I wanted to do something a little bit more diverse out in the world. And this is, I'm dating myself now, so we're talking about the 90s. And I said, I'm going to go into economics and business administration. And, and again, the ratios changed, and there were more women and more females in the class, in the classes that I had to take. But the third milestone being, just last year, 2021, December, my team and I, we took a blank check company, a SPAC, public. It's a lifestyle technology company. 300 million, it was upsized. And this is just 2021, 6, 7 months ago. And we did it. It was a great accomplishment. We listed it on NASDAQ. And I looked it up, and only 3% of 550 plus SPACs in 2021 were women-led or had women in the management team. And so, yes, the percentages have changed from 0.5% in the 90s to 3% in 2021. But I feel like we have to all kind of come together and realize that there are many, many people that are underrepresented. It's not just about women, just minorities and people that from different parts of the, being an immigrant myself, different parts of the world that can be uplifted and empowered and brought into this amazing circle of technology and business and founding companies and being an entrepreneur. And so, yeah, those are the milestones that shape my trajectory moving forward. That's the areas that I want to work on, empowerment and upliftment of underrepresented communities in business and technology.
You know, it's really fascinating. I just want to impact some of your milestones. So you come as an immigrant and you enter this culture in North America, and there's a transition point. And as you indicated, it was you know, there was this sort of challenge, right, of assimilating it within the environment and sort of learning the culture. Were there any one or two particular things that really stood out at the time that were a big challenge and then you were overcome, or maybe a great opportunity that you were able to maximize being somebody from another environment and coming into North America?
You know, my story was so unique in that way, Stephen, that even though I was an immigrant and a person of color and female, I have never encountered sexism or racism to my face, like, you know, overtly. It must have happened somewhere, you know, but I've never faced it. And I think that's a blessing. I don't think the point of that is to say that it doesn't happen or never happened or no, but my experience, my life experience was that I was lucky. I was blessed. I never overtly felt undermined or undercut or disadvantaged. So it was full of opportunities. And yes, it was hard. You know, it was hard to assimilate culturally, to learn to the accent and the words. And even to this day, when I speak with you right now, I'm translating in my head. So sometimes some words come off wrong, not because of the intention, but because I am translating in my head and there's a little bit of delay or a glitch or a lag, you know, between brain to ears. And so those subtle things were my biggest challenges. I didn't have overt challenges like that many people, and this is where I have to say, just because my experience was different, that doesn't mean other people have similar experiences. In fact, some people face much more hardship and really in their face discrimination. And maybe I have, and I just don't know, and I'm just unaware, but that's okay. My role is to think through other people's eyes and their experiences. So I would say my biggest challenge was culturally getting to a point where I was home and where America or the States became my home. I think that was the biggest transition, and leaving your home and your family and your friends that you grew up with, you know, over 14 years, and then making a new life in a new country with new norms, new culture, new ways. You know, that to me was my biggest challenge, but it was also my biggest opportunity. Because I think a lot of people and situations might have let me down or disappointed me, but my career, my schooling never did. I never would let it, because it was the one thing that was mine and that I could form and forge. And so that's the kind of thing that I would love young girls and young men from all over the world, like anyone who listens to this, thinking that it's really hard. Yes, it's really hard. But the one thing you can form is your education, your exposure to things, your passions, your interests, and your career. And if you put all of your intentions and your hard work and your research and your passion into it, if you can find something that you're passionate about to pursue, those challenges become smaller and smaller and smaller. And they're there, but their power diminishes. So, you know, there was not one moment or one adversity or one you know, something negative that happened, and I'm blessed for that. And I can actually look back and acknowledge that.
You know, I'm just going to ask maybe a couple of more questions about your inflection points. The other being, you indicated you were in Berkeley and you spent 2 years coding, and then you went to economics.
Yeah.
And economics has a lot of math in it. So were you sort of like a math whiz in high school and things like that, or?
You know, in India, we get put, like, at least back in the day, we always got put into classes where, you know, you're one or two years younger than your peers, or at least maybe in my family, that's what happened. I don't know. But like, so when I was 14, I'm hanging around with 16-year-olds because I was a couple years younger. So I don't think I was a whiz in any way, shape, or form. I think I was forced to adapt to peers that were much older than me. See, in the States today, and I have a nine-year-old, I would never think that that would be okay for her to be in a class where there's 11-year-olds and her studying at the same time, the same material. But that's today and now. We're a lot more aware and sensitive to child development and maturity and all those things. You know, growing up in India, you know, I didn't even know that I was a couple years younger than all of my friends today. So that was like the hurt. I think that's where I felt like I had some advantage or coping skills or something kicked in, because I could have flunked my way with peers that were 1 to 2 years older, but instead I somehow managed to keep up. So no, I was not a math whiz at all. I have to work very hard. Coding did not come to me easy, but I did it. I finished my minor in computer science. I double minored in business and computer science. And then of course, economics was my thing. Financial markets, supply demand, theory, policy, everything about economics was just who I was. And so I'm really glad that I took that move away from engineering and away from being a programmer into something a little bit broader like economics, because it speaks to who I am. And if I had my dredgers, I'd be working in the United Nations and doing policy or research or whatever. But it gave me the opportunity to choose my lane. And the lane I actually pursued was not the United Nations. And it was not policy. It was not demographics or politics. It was actually Wall Street. And I ended up managing client assets and becoming a money manager, an asset manager, and a wealth manager. It led to many. The economics degree was so broad. I could have gotten anywhere with it, but instead I actually chose to be in investment management. And I think that's where it's interesting that when we're in college, we really should be sampling as many majors as we can to really find who we are. And yeah, I went in thinking I wanted to be an engineer, you know, typical Indian stereotype, engineer or doctor. I came out being neither, but I feel like it changed the direction of my life in a way that I'm actually really proud of it. And I'm happier because I feel like I went towards an occupation or a career that spoke more to who I am. So back to your question, no, not a math whiz at all. But I know how to get it done if I have to, do it. And I think that is the biggest skill we can have, the sense of confidence that I can get it done, or I will figure it out, or I can learn it. I think that was one of the biggest moments that I call a milestone.
But, the world is really interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary or transdisciplinary. And the fact that you got the sort of science background and you were coding, and it's Berkeley, Berkeley's a top school as well, and very demanding. So, and you spent 2 years, so that would give you just such an excellent foundation in technology and an appreciation of technology. And technology underpins everything that's out there in many respects, right? And then you move into economics, which really has a strong mathematic base as well, yeah, or a strong data,
data
base. Mm-hmm. And then you're working as an asset manager. So now you're applying all of these different skills into, and being very successful, actually, managing billions and billions and essentially being a superstar in that area. And I guess that's bringing, what skills do you think, what aspects that made you such a superstar in asset management and finance?
It's understanding that there's emotions attached to the concept of money, that each of us have a relationship with money. Each of us come with our baggage and our arrows in our quiver when it comes to the concept of money or wealth or abundance, because we're programmed by society, by our families, by our friends, by who we hung around when we were kids and what cues we picked up consciously and also subconsciously, what we were taught and what we were not taught. I mean, the fact that you go through, a solid undergrad and solid grad school and never learn a thing about personal finance in this day and age is shocking to me. I mean, we should be teaching our youth, the next generation, you know, about simple, you know, forget economics. I mean, they need to learn about simple personal finance tricks and tips and how to the rule of 72 and how to manage debt and credit cards and how to, this concept of abundance, that greed, you know, is detrimental to society, but also to oneself, and learning this concept of I have enough, or I have more than enough, and now I can give back to society, or I can reinvest into the society. These concepts are not taught. You either stumble upon them, or you're lucky if you were born into a family that kind of had that practice and passed it down. But most of us stumble and struggle through it to get to it, and some of us don't get there, and we lead very stressful and unhealthy and toxic lives, not because we want to, but because our relationship with money is toxic, you know, and no one shed light on that. And so I think my special sauce when I work with clients, so we manage money for 80,000 households across North America and Canada. It was $16 billion under management. It was not easy. It was very emotional. Markets went up, markets went down, markets went sideways. Competitive, right? Very competitive space. But everyone was there because they wanted to achieve their goals. They wanted to retire. They wanted to send their kids to college or start a business or put their feet up and relax or whatever it was. They were working very hard, earning a lot of money, saving it, investing it for what? To achieve their goals, to achieve their dreams. And I think what gave me a little bit of an edge is I always felt like I got the emotional, psychological component of money and the relationship with money. So when I would sit across from them, it was not about fees and risk management and returns and beating the markets and beating the indices and beating the benchmarks and beating their neighbors and how their neighbors did versus they did. It was really, yeah, a little bit about that because it has to be, right? But it was more about like, let's talk about this thing that no one else is talking to you about. And so all our conversations, all our relationships became so much deeper and so much more meaningful. And so then all our decisions became a lot more strategic. They became almost like, they became smart decisions, like specific, they were measurable, they were achievable, they were realistic, you know. Because we were talking about things that no one else was talking about, the outcomes were actually quite interesting and quite satisfying. And so no matter what the markets did, I always had really good relationships with my clients. That was the best part of it all. And I think that's what gave myself and my team an edge, is we were really close to our clients.
You know, that's kind of fascinating because, you know, you come from this really quantitative background. Yeah. And then you learn this relationship emotional aspect, the emotional quotient aspect, and you realize that's really, really important. If you were to put a number on it, would you say that that's like 90% of success is really the people element, or 50%, or are you able to quantify in some rough way from just your own personal experience?
Yeah, I love 60-40 portfolios in retirement. Like that's when you're retired, you should have a 60-40 portfolio where 60% of it is in stocks and 40% in things that are like bonds, gold, cash, things, right? Like there's a 60-40 in retirement goal that we all strive for in financial planning or advising. And so I like to use that reference for the success factor. I think 60% of it is going to be skill. It's going to be your education. It's going to be your experience. It's going to be what you know. And more importantly, what you learn along the way. But the 40%, truly, the 40% is going to be knowing to understand the relationship and the psychology and the emotions and the equations that are not skills-based or something you can learn, pay to learn. It's everything that you cannot pay anyone to learn. It's just you learn from life, or you learn from your family, or you learn by force because you just have to adapt or you have to cope or whatever. So yeah, I would give it a 60-40. I think skill is obviously the most important. Your training is the most important. Your experiences is the most important. But at some level, you know, initially it's 90-10. right? It's more about the skill because you're young and you have to demonstrate that you know what you're talking about, that you're credible, that you can be trusted, that you have knowledge, that you have wisdom. You know, you have to impress upon your clients or potential clients. Eventually, with time, I think that number goes towards 60-40. And it's less about what you know. It's more about what you can share and empower the person across the table with. And that is less about skill and technical knowledge. And I think it's a lot more about relationships.
You know, that's, again, fascinating. And then you move your career out of asset management. You become an entrepreneur. How did that occur? What created that catalyst to make this really big change in essence, right? And it's a different mindset to be an entrepreneur. So
it is. And I think that's the frontier. I'm so used to working for someone, right? My entire career, from working at Khanna Communications, which was the original ERM company, to Oracle, working at American Express, that then became Ameriprise Financial, working at Charles Schwab for, you know, almost 10 years, working at Loring Board. I mean, so I know how to work for people. I know how to report up and manage up and sideways and down and have teams. So, you know, the next frontier, I think, logically for me, in that moment was, what can I learn beyond? And I think it was this entrepreneurial mindset, starting something, taking on the risk of it completely failing, taking on the risk of it being completely successful, and not really having to manage up, sideways, and down. You're just managing yourself, and you're managing, you know, the other co-founders. You know, it's a different dynamic. And I needed to know that I could do it. I needed to know that I could help found something or be an entrepreneur, because I felt like working for someone and being an entrepreneur are two different things. And so, yeah, it was hard. It was not easy, because the way you're trained when you work for someone, those would keep coming out. And that's not what's needed when you're trying to kickstart a company or take it public or be a founder or be an entrepreneur. So yeah, absolutely. It was a transition, and I needed to know I could do it. And I'm glad I tried it. And I guess the lesson in all of this is there's so much risk in everything we do, but I think the biggest risk is not trying, because if we don't try, we won't know if we can do it.
And you've succeeded, and you continue to succeed with this entrepreneurial mindset and really going out there. And it's a rare quality. So if you were to give advice to others who are either very early in their careers or mid or even later in their careers, and they make the decision, well, I'm going to start a company. I'm going to do a startup. What are your tips for success? Because you've got success.
Well, my number one advice is never give advice unless you're asked for it. And the reason I ask, or the reason I say that, is that I think in modern day of technology, where everything's available online, you can coach yourself, you can teach yourself, you can, you know, you can learn, self-learn. There's so much empowerment that the computer, the internet, social media, all of these things have given us all these amazing tools where if you want to figure something out, or if you need advice, you can get it. And so people have access to advice, where 40, 50, 60 years ago, advice was passed down from generations and from family and from your friends and from your teachers. It was different, right? The dynamics were different because you didn't have free access to advice. It was not a free market. It was very exclusive. And now it's very inclusive. Anyone can help themselves. And so my one advice is, I've learned this the hard way, is only give advice when you are asked for it, because that means that person needs to know your experience set and not somebody else's. And so I always say that I will give you my answer because you asked for it. So we check that box. But I would say it's this concept of emotional adulthood. And if I have this memorized in my head, but I will share with you a little poem. It's not a poem, it's like a long quote by one of my mentors. And I think honestly, the recipe for success is all baked into the short poem. So if you don't mind, I'll share with you. And it says, acceptance is the key to the equation of emotional adulthood. Only acceptance can keep you emotionally tranquil. Non-acceptance creates emotional agitation within. So when something is happening that is not the way we want and we accept it, it's called tolerance. When we don't accept it, it becomes anger. What is fear? Fear is that you're about to experience some uncertainty or something negative. It's that anticipation that something negative is going to happen. So when I encounter uncertainty, it causes fear within me. When someone goes to climb Mount Everest or they want to go rafting down the Pacquiao River, they face the same uncertainty, but they call it adventure. When I'm facing uncertainty and I'm not able to accept it, then it becomes fear, right? And when I accept uncertainty, then it's that whole experience of adventure. And so the whole thing about being, you know, not hitting our goals or being jealous that someone hit some goal or success factor that we wanted to, comparing ourselves to other people and feeling like we don't match up, you know, those are elements of jealousy. They come from not being able to achieve what we want to achieve. But when we see other people achieving success that we haven't been able to achieve, and we spin that mindset and treat it as inspiration instead of jealousy, then we can actually achieve our own goals and go beyond our, you know, beyond our dreams, beyond our goals. We're not limited by our own imagination. And so it's this thing about acceptance that I think this short poem, this long quote is what has, I think, bottled up all these factors of how to be successful in career, in business, in the world, in life is acceptance. Just accept things for what they are. And affirm to yourself and then act. So acceptance, affirmation, and action, I would say is basically the little secret sauce in there.
You know, that's really interesting. You know, acceptance, acclimation, and then action. You know, that's still like triple A's, right?
Yeah.
And I guess in my mind, I would also put stretch. Always stretch as well, you know, so you're accepting, but you also want to stretch to yes. to extend your capabilities. That's an easy thing to remember. So
yeah.
That's a great piece of advice.
And I think the stretch, to your point of what you just mentioned, is really important, because everything in small sprints is achievable. Like if we break down, you know, the biggest problem into bite-sized pieces, the impossible becomes possible. But the smallest problem as a chunk can feel so daunting, right? And so what you just mentioned is really key, is that we have to stretch ourselves in small sprints or bite-sized pieces, because we are only using a very small percentage of our brains. We are you know, our bodies are capable of healing itself. I mean, we're a machine. We're just like that computer that we're sitting across from. We're brilliant inside, each and every one of us, right? We're systems that's working efficiently and running smoothly. And it knows that it has this intelligence that's not artificial. It's real, right? We're the real intelligence sitting across from artificial intelligence, making that connection and making things happen. But we have that intelligence, each and every one of us within. And so we can stretch gracefully, and we can stretch without blowing a fuse and crashing and burning. And I do agree that, yes, acceptance is the first key. But then, you know, if there was an A for stretching, I would stick it in there as a fourth A. But it is very important. And I think it should be either in the acceptance category or actually even in the affirmation category. Affirm to yourself that you can grow, you can learn, and you can stretch.
You know, again, just such an amazing piece of advice for the audience. I now want to mind just a little bit about or unpack a little bit about, you know, you founded this company, you did a SPAC, and explain that process, what that was like, and talk a little bit more about the company, what allowed you, you know, created this concept of being the CIO and co-founder and starting this initiative, and then, you know, having it now listed on NASDAQ. And, you know, what was the inspiration for that? And, you know, what do you hope to achieve beyond where you are now?
So the last 5 years, I've been dedicated to social impact as just, that's like my journey for the rest of my time on this planet. That's what I want to work on. So what we decided, a small group of friends, what we decided is, what can we do that brings all of our skills together to drive social impact in the business world? Because as you know, our problems are trillion-dollar problems. Aid and philanthropy combined are hundreds of millions of dollars solutions, if not billion-dollar solutions. Billions cannot counteract trillions. So at some level, there's this big gap. If you take all the aid in the world and you take all the philanthropy in the world and you put it together against the problem, it doesn't really solve the problem or end the problem. So what's the delta? What's the stuff in the middle? It's entrepreneurship, it's jobs, it's businesses. Because though every business employs many people, and every person then affects the next gen, their next generation and their lives and their families' lives. And so, you know, really the missing piece is creating businesses that have a social impact, not just goal, but an active intention to pursue some sort of social impact through the business. And if businesses can become more mindful, new businesses that start up can become more mindful, no matter what line of business they're in, I think we can change the world. We can end poverty, we can end homelessness, we can probably end you know, a lot of issues that we're dealing with, climate and environment and food insecurity and all of those things, because that way we're scaling. Just like any piece of technology, you're able to scale solutions and make them sustainable, but also grow your impact. And so this whole SPAC was a beginning, you know, it was the beginning of how can we create social impact beyond our philanthropy and beyond our donations and beyond our, you know, working for companies that have an ESG goal or an SRI goal. How can we do it more front and center? And how can we make that the primary motivation to start? And so right now, that's the goal. Unfortunately, I can't, because it's a SPAC and we're in a quiet period, I can't share quite as much detail as I would like to as to what it is going to end up being. But in general, a SPAC is a blank check company. You raise capital, you get a bunch of institutional investors, accredited investors together. You raise capital with an investment thesis. And our investment thesis is lifestyle technology. Why? Because I think technology and life are merging more and more. We're all in front of our phones all day and computers all day. How can we make that productive? How can we make that time and that exposure, that screen time, productive? And so it's a lifestyle technology company. It's really about helping people through technology improve their life style, their life experience. I think that's going to be the future of you know, the next endeavor is how do we use technology to our benefit, where it doesn't stress us out, where it can help us heal, it can help us grow, it can help us learn, it can help us create businesses, it can help us have fun, but all in a way that is good for us and good for the planet. So yeah, the whole SPAC idea just came from a genesis of wanting to do something in the business world that drove social impact and had a mission of the betterment of humanity as being the end result versus the bottom line. So we really have a triple bottom line agenda. Yes, we want to close a profit. Yes, we want to have purpose. And yes, we want to drive legacy. So it's PPNL strategy, I guess. Yeah. And yeah, we'll see how it shakes out because we're still in the early stages of the SPAC. It went public in December of last year. And so all fingers and toes crossed, anything can happen in the business world, but we're marching forward and we're hoping to make a very strong and sound acquisition of a tech unicorn and take it public on NASDAQ through our acquisition of that company.
Okay, so because you marry, you know, the financial markets and you're an entrepreneur and you have this technology background as well, and very, very successful in the asset management side and the finance side. If you can maybe wear your predictive hat, what do you see as some of the big major shifts that we, the audience, should be aware of? And how can we best prepare? So that's kind of one element. And I want to continue this journey. And then I want to get more into the social impact side, some of the things, your pet projects. And then, in other words, the things that you're putting your time in your reputation behind that you really believe in, initiatives from an impact side. So first of all, let's continue with that first question. And you know, what would be your sort of your predictive forecast of things where, you know, where we have to pay attention to right now?
I would say, you know, there's some big shifts happening, which is great because we all there has to be an evolution of the ways we do things, business, life, so the future of work. You know, I think technology is going to change everything. It's just up to us whether, our inner intelligence and that artificial intelligence can marry in a way that it's actually better for all versus just for a small group of people versus harming people. So I think that's an active decision we all have to make as entrepreneurs, as builders, as technologists, as investors. Where do we want to drive our capital? Where do we want to drive our reputations and our skills? Like, what do we want to help achieve? And all of that is changing and up for grabs, and it's up to be formed, right? It's not destined yet. We're forming it as we go along. But I think a couple of the shifts that I'm seeing that are happening that I'm really happy about is I think philanthropy is changing. So as someone who loves to forward or amplify causes and nonprofits and organizations, even social impact ventures that are small globally, I feel like the way we are giving in society is changing. And people like McKinsey Scott, for example, are helping us do that. How? Well, they're trend bucking. Usually philanthropy and the charitable world is very much about, it's my dollars and I'm giving it to you, so I'm doing you a favor. So you need to do what I want you to do. And it has to be a cause that I like. And you need to achieve results that I find sufficient. And then maybe I'll give you more next year. It was very patriarchal in a way. It was very like, yeah, I tell you what to do because it's my money. There's ego attached to it. And I think what she's doing as a philanthropist and as a just a powerhouse, is she saying, no, I'm going to find teams that I believe in who are running their nonprofit or their venture well, and I'm going to support you through a trust-based philanthropy. I'm going to show you that you're worthy of my trust, and I will give you and fund you so that you can do more of what you're doing because you're kicking butt. And that little bit of trust and that little bit of like confidence where she's confidentially giving large sums of money and she allows the organization to publicize whether they want to say that they got a grant from her or not, it's empowerment. I don't know if she's doing it intentionally or not, but I'm pretty sure she's intentional about empowering the teams and showing them that she trusts them and that that is different. It's trend bucking in the world of philanthropy. So that's one thing that's happening is philanthropy is changing, charity is changing. People are very quickly letting organizations know if they're going to be funded or not. I know it sounds really simple, like why would it be any different? But you know, usually the turnaround time or the life cycle of getting a grant or getting a sizable donation is so long. And these short-staffed organizations spin their wheels for months and months and years to try to close somebody who then decides that you know, it didn't meet their due diligence standards or whatever it might be. And they feel so let down and it's inefficient. And so as business owners and entrepreneurs, we know efficiency is everything. And so I feel like trust-based philanthropy is efficient and effective. And if you have the courage to be that way and do it that way, I think that's the future. So that's one thing. And that's speaking of philanthropy and charity. The second would be that I think we all have to figure out how we can scale the good. I think companies, brands, everyone's interested in going behind social causes, and that's really wonderful. But we got to figure out how we can scale that, because 0.5% of anything is a small amount, you know? And so how do we get more and more people involved and acting? You know, again, the same thing about accept, affirm, act. The act piece has to go up. You know, we want to go beyond talking and messaging and go into action. So I really think that companies are going to go really big into beyond ESG, beyond environmental social governance, just to make their stakeholders happy. They're going to do it for the right reasons, not just to check a box, but actually to make a difference and make an impact and act. And they're also, the investing world is going to get really big on SRI, socially responsible investing, and not the old SRI, which was all about exclusion and excluding tobacco and excluding firearm stocks and excluding this and excluding that. Well, that's fine. That was the old paradigm. I think the new paradigm of SRI is going to be, how do you include investing in businesses that are doing good instead of having an exclusionary funnel, right? So those are three things that I see happening in the world of our life experience, but also social good.
You know, again, very, very sound advice and, you know, and insights that you're giving to the audience. But before I get into your specific areas of social impact interests outside of, you know, the work that you're doing right now with other organizations or communities, are you working with any CEO organizations or things like that? Or are you members of any of them, like Entrepreneur or YPO or some of the other ones that are out there?
I'm actually not. And that's one of the things that I'm exploring. And you've been instrumental in sharing that these are some of the concepts that we need to bring to CECP, or we need to bring to YPO or EO, or all these so many amazing, amazing professional organizations. This has been one of my goals, to try to figure out what's the best way to bring some of these best practices. You know, there's nothing to sell here. There's no like, there's no product, there's nothing to sell, but it's more like, how do you bring some of this just as inspiration or ideas to groups of people that are passionate and really devoting time, their time and their energy on. But yeah, I am actually not on any of those, and have considered what role perhaps, you know, anything that I know, you know, how could I share it to a bigger group? But I do feel that so far my impact has been working with individual nonprofits, individual foundations, individual endowments, individual social impact ventures. And at some point, I'll need to converge to the more efficient model of one to many instead of one to one.
Yeah, I mean, we use some acronyms here. So just for the benefit of the audience, you mentioned CE, Chief Executives for Common Purpose, so CECP. There's HALA, the Higher Ambition Leadership Alliance. There's YPO, which is a young president's organization. There's another organization called Entrepreneur Organization. There's a CEO organization, which typically YPOers can graduate to this one if they're really impactful and successful. There's the Danish Management Society based out of Copenhagen. I mean, there's so many of them. There's the CEO Leadership Alliance out of Southern California, but they recently had a national sort of summit bringing together something like close to 20 other CEO, regional CEO groups. There's the Leaders on Purpose, or LOP, which are working with multinationals. So there's a number of them where you could you would be a catalyst for them, or I can see how all of your insights and the work you're doing would be so beneficial for them. So I just want to give the audience a little bit of background, because, you know, we're talking about different kinds of organizations. I now want to move and shift to, you know, the separate organizations out of the companies and the ones that you're working with that you really are supporting. And I know from a prior conversation that KIN is one, that's the knowledge network, this Knowledge Impact Network. And there's SoLight. I think it's really interesting what you're doing with that and others. So can you talk about KIN and why you're so interested in KIN, this Knowledge Impact Network?
Well, because KIN was formed from a few of the YPO leaders, right? So the founders of KIN are former and current YPO network folks. And so they started off doing, you know, knowledge being the asset, the asset that we share, that we give. You remember the giving pledge? They did the knowledge pledge, which is you give your knowledge, your skills to the greater cause. And I think that's very noble. But beyond noble, I think it's very practical. Now, imagine all of us, all the knowledge we're each individually sitting on, right? All the things we know how to do because it's a part of our day-to-day job, or skills we've picked up, or networks we have, or you know, information we have that is not part of our day-to-day job, but we have, you know, we have gathered over our lifetimes, our careers. And it's all sitting there. It's all archived in the back of our minds because we're not using all of it at one time, right? So imagine taking a portion of that and applying it or deploying it strategically to a certain cause that needs that skill, right? And so I think that's what's really powerful. And I think that, you know, we should be doing more of that. And I think companies, businesses, small to mid-sized businesses that, Stephen, don't have a CSR army, like a corporate social responsibility army, they can work with organizations like KIN to inspire, engage, retain their, yes, their key leaders and, you know, their executives, but also their rising executives, their employees, and the next generation, their pipeline, their employee pipeline, right? The people that they'll hire 5 years from now that are watching the company and watching the values of the company and seeing if the company is brave enough to allow its employees and its leaders to speak values into action on company time with company support, right? Not on their own, but, you know, through the company and so via the company. And so, you know, organizations like KIN are going to become more and more important as small to mid-sized companies figure out that they do have a voice, they can take action, and they can do it strategically, you know, and they can do it without spinning their wheels and hiring a bunch of people and spending a lot of money, investing in internal assets to create, you know, internal resources. They can actually partner up with external resources like KIN and get the job done and actually get it done really well.
And then you have this SoLight Empowerment, Global Youth Empowerment Project, Africa, India, South America. Yeah. And in fact, in looking at that work, I can do some introductions. I think there's some good fits.
I'm sure you can.
Have you talked to the MasterCard Foundation too? Because they're really heavy in Africa as well.
Yeah, no, I have not. And I would love any introductions. Absolutely. Any and all of those introductions would be key. So essentially, we're trying to create additional livelihoods in remote and rural areas that are within Africa or India or South America. Really, every country has a rural, remote population where access to something as simple as light is a privilege. And it's so sad, right? We take light for granted, and they are used to rolling blackouts and walking in darkness, crime because it's really dark and you can't identify who attacked you. And this is gruesome crime. It's not just theft. You know, I'm talking about safety and young women and men getting jumped because they're going to go use the bathroom in the dark. So something so germane, so basic, light, right, can cause so many problems when it's not available. And it's when it's not free, and it's one, it's expensive, and two, it's not available. And so using solar technology, solar light, to bring one light, but two, to avoid the use of kerosene to create light, because that's the alternative, right? Kerosene is expensive. It's also very dangerous for the health. It can flare up asthma. You can get burnt on it. And it's not a clean fuel. It's toxic. And usually these homes and huts don't have proper ventilation, and they don't know about the harms of kerosene. So they're probably inhaling a lot of negative long-term side effects and without even knowing it, but they don't have a choice. And so if we can use science and technology to benefit them and empower them with solar lights that the sun charges and that can last them 5 to 10 years, they only have to buy one or get one, and then it lasts them, 7 to 10 years, and they charge it for free thanks to the sun. And they understand how solar technology works, and they understand the power of the sun. Imagine all those girls and those boys that are in these remote huts without power, burning kerosene lamps to just do their homework at night or do their handwork at night. Imagine like the doors it opens up for them in terms of understanding how powerful our natural resources are, and that maybe someday they can go become a scientist or a technologist or an engineer or a mathematician, and they can see something beyond what they know now. It's just like sampling, right? Again, it's exposure to different things. So we really wanted to create some sort of a extra livelihood program for them. And we also wanted to create some sort of an extra education that's online about STEM related topics, so that they're not limited to working in a hotel or, you know, creating crafts as their livelihood. They can certainly do that if that's what they want to do. If that's their forte, that's their passion, that's their skill set, they should pursue that. But if they wanted to do something a little bit more technical and a little bit more scientific, they should get exposure to this as early on as possible. And then that way they can dream big and they can pursue those lines of work, and then start a company of their own or a small business of their own. And so it's really about exposing them to science and technology in bite-sized pieces and allowing them to create additional sources of livelihood above and beyond how they're earning their livelihood now.
So what's the maturity level of the Solight project right now? Is it still very early stage, or are you sort of mid-scale? And before you answer, I just want to do a time check, because to the audience, these are just interactive freeform dialogues. And can you go beyond the hour? Or
yes, absolutely. No, I don't have a hard stop. I think we blocked an hour and a half to chat. So okay. I certainly thank you for that. I respect that. But yeah, we can go beyond the hour as we need. Yes, this project is new. We have some amazing partners in South Africa. We have the Distell Group, which is actually, I think, in the process of getting merged or bought out by Heineken. So it's their foundation and their corporate that, you know, we're partnering up with. And then they've introduced us to the Ray Malaba Foundation. Ray Malaba was Mandela's, one of his best friends. And sorry about that. It was one of his best friends, and also was imprisoned with Nelson Mandela, with Madiba. And so he has his foundation and his family foundation. And then we have Amy Foundation. And Amy Foundation is from a lady who was, she was white. She was attacked in South Africa. Her family forgave the attackers, and they created a foundation for the benefit of local South Africans. Just amazing, amazing lessons on forgiveness and also on giving back. And so we're working very closely. They all have their skill centers, which is great. They are teaching young South African women and men basic skills. They're teaching them basic financial literacy topics, all the things that you and I talked about on this call that are really important. They're doing that. And so we thought, why not partner with them and field them, give them the capital and give them the lights and give them the support and the backing to go beyond helping 300 to 400 to more. With our expertise, sharing our knowledge, sharing our expertise, sharing our products, giving them the ammo so that they can do more of what they're already been doing.
Are you planning to scale to other parts of Africa? I mean, Africa is a pretty complex continent, and people sometimes think of Africa as just one, but really it's many, many different communities and nations, each with their own sort of personalized requirements, right? So what's your scaling program for Solight?
So what we're also doing is thinking about how we can really go beyond, partner up with many solar light companies. You know, there are quite a few out there and they're all doing it a little differently. They all have their own patents and their ways of how they've developed the solar technology, which is really impressive. So we're trying to really approach, bring together consortium, a group of solar light brands and companies that are all doing the same things and trying to do the right thing and the same thing, which is bring solar technology applications to everyday lives, right? We're trying to also approach many foundations and corporate brands in Africa. Like you said, Africa is a collection of many countries and they are all culturally different. Their language, their culture, their everything is unique to every country. And even within a country, there's many tribes and cultures within one country. So our goal is to start in South Africa and then to expand through our networks with Thai Global Artisans and Pixera Global. We want to expand to Ghana because they have great connections in Ghana. Our goal is also to extend to Kenya. And so right now it's a three-prong approach in Africa. It's South Africa, Ghana, and Kenya. We hope to really go to as many places as we need. I'm from India, so I have connections back in India. And then we are, because of our proximity to Mexico and South America, living in North America, we have many connections and network here. So the other goal is to hit places, rural communities in Mexico and Central America, and then move down south. So yeah, the goal is to scale and to hit many, many different countries across the globe.
So just a little bit of brainstorming then, are you working with Beebox by any chance or the Equity Bank?
Not yet, but I would love any introductions that or any ideas that come to mind.
Right. Or Florian Kemmerich, I guess. And, you know, he's got a number of funds.
Yes, Bamboo. In fact, I know Care Enterprises. They are the ones that do the care packages. A great organization. They actually have some amazing gender equity funds. And Florian and Bamboo Capital Partners is the fund manager for their funds. And so, yes, I do know Florian, do know Care. It would be great to actually integrate it in a larger organization that's been doing it for Care's been doing it for over 50 years. So, you know, they've been in the space for a long time. And gender equity is a big play in all of this, right? Only because, you know, in some of these remote rural areas, gender inequities are even greater, right? As you can imagine, education is less, access is less, empowerment. I mean, they don't even have light. So, you know, it would be great to partner up with the organizations that you mentioned.
So, you know, this is towards the end of our discussion here. Is there any other areas that you want to sort of spotlight? And then I'll ask one final question.
You know, there's so many areas that I'd like to spotlight. I'm on the advisory board or the board of about 13 nonprofits, as well as funds, endowment funds that are doing some important work. End Poverty, Make Trillions. You know, it's an endowment fund to fight poverty in the U.S., to bring people above the poverty line. It's a federal legislative bill plus a fund, a $1 billion fund. There is an amazing, amazing fund by Community Solutions that's trying to curb homelessness. It's a real estate fund, a housing fund, and it's epically unique, the model. I mean, if anyone has any interest in getting my recommendation or my picks on some of the best people out there that are working on some of the biggest and worst problems that are humanity is facing and our next generation will face, please let me know, because there's so many and I'd love to spotlight each and every one of them if I could.
I guess one final idea just popped in my head, and that's Michael Meehan. Have you worked with him at all? He chairs the Sustainability Financial Alliance out of the UK.
Yes, I have not worked with him, but he would be exactly the thought would be his the alignment is just would be amazing.
Yeah, and I think it's about 15 trillion US right now that they have assets under management, right? Yep. And it's all ESG focused,
yep.
Right?
Or yep. Okay. He's definitely who I want to be when I grow up, you know. If someone's doing it right, you have, again, that inspiration versus jealousy thing in the poem, right? I take inspiration from people like him because I think they really have the right idea and they're crushing it. They're taking a right idea and they're making it successful, which is so inspirational.
So we're down to our final question. And the final question is, how can people find, well, I guess maybe two parts. How can people find out more about what you're doing and all the boards you sit on and all the projects that you really are passionate about? That's one part. So they have a go-to location, right? And then the second part of the question, or a final question, is what are your final recommendations to our audience?
I would say the biggest recommendation is get involved, and you have so much you can offer, each and every one of us, even the ones who are listening from some remote place in anywhere in the world, and have nothing. You have your intellect, you have your skills, you have your dedication, your passion. There's so much you have to offer. So never feel like you don't have something to give. We all do. And sadly, the most privileged ones of us that are probably listening, we have so much to give and we may not feel it. We may be working to attain more before we give, or attain to retire before we give, or we don't know how to give because there's just so much information out there and so many different organizations. Like, how do you choose? And these are all great problems. But at the end of the day, I think each of us can, quadruple what we're doing now easily and wouldn't really affect the quality of our life. In fact, we would get so much back in return from the impact we're having on the world and strangers, people we don't know, that whose lives we're changing. So keep doing it. Keep stretching yourself. Going back to just accept. Just affirm, stretch, act, and know that you're not alone. There's many, many people like you and like Stephen, like myself, that are here. We're together. No one's alone on this. And, if you need to reach out or you need to get together or have an idea or want to make a connection or have something to offer, absolutely reach out to myself, to Stephen, to Ken, any of these organizations that we mentioned. They're all great. And we're all here to collaborate for progress. We're not here to compete to make a difference. And so please reach out to anyone and all of us, and you'll get a different perspective and you'll be able to be part of something amazing.
Well, Payal, thank you for coming in today and, sharing so much with our audience. And it was very inspiring and so much commitment. You're doing all of this work for the benefit of humanity and Earth's ecosystems. And really for the benefit of all, and that all is all encompassing. So thank you again.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. And it's always, always great to chat with you, Stephen.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.